Welcome to Worlds Apart. Some 30 years ago, just as the Soviet Union was about to collapse, Francis Fukuyama pronounced the end of history, giving a science expression to a pretty simple American craving for eternal dominance. The flaws of this theory became apparent pretty quickly, in part because what matters in the final analysis is not only where history ends, but also where it begins. In trying to understand the war in Ukraine and what it means for the rest of the world, how far down memory lane should we go? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Riaz Tayob, researcher for the South African chapter of the Southern and East African Trade Institute. Mr. Tayob, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Riaz will do just fine.
Riaz, it's a great pleasure talking to you. And I think from reading some of your recent articles, we share similar distaste for neocon politics, this intention of launching wars in the name of all the good against all the bad, and sometimes, or most of the times, living scorching lands in the aftermath. But for some reason, this scenario seems to be happening over and over again. I covered the wars in Libya or in Syria just a couple of years ago, and nowadays everybody forgot about it. It seems that the only war that exists in the media space right now is the war in Ukraine. And while it's a pretty horrible outcome for Russia first and foremost, I wonder, why do you think this cycle of, you know, each new war replacing the memory of the previous ones, why do you think this cycle goes on?
I think we have a global hegemon, which is the United States. And the United States has been taken over by a cabal of neoconservative thinkers and practitioners like Victoria Nuland and the Kagans and so on. So Gore Vidal, the famous writer, called the United States of amnesia, because, you know, everything in the media there is sound bites and is more psychology than fact. So we have the domination of the information space by the US, with Twitter putting people like Scott Ritter off and so on. So there's the traditional manufacturing of consent. And even more concerning is that there is an oversimplification of very complex issues. One can, for instance, at a human level, be against violence and against the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. But if you look at it at a geopolitical level, one can see that both Russia and China are being surrounded by American or NATO military bases. And the assertion is that the NATO is a defensive alliance, but I think brown people like Libyans or Syrians or Iraqis would say that this is certainly not the case, and at least for the Afghanis. So, you know, the perspective from Africa is that we want to be neutral vis-a-vis this war. It doesn't mean we don't have compassion with the Ukrainians or the Russians. Both people are dying on both sides. At the geopolitical level, one can see that the Russians were backed into a corner and almost had no option. On the other hand, at the national level, one must respect the rights of the Ukrainians, like many Africans, who are struggling for self-determination. You know, decolonization wasn't just decolonization, it was a process for self-determination. So this struggle with the neocons is also at a civilizational level. You mentioned Fukuyama, but you didn't mention Samuel Huntington in his Clash of Civilizations, you know, arguing that there's no prospect for, you know, anything else but liberal internationalism. But in that entire book, he doesn't mention Africa, as if we don't exist. And this is a serious, serious problem, because we are players in the world. We do contribute resources to the global economy and provide services and production to the international division of labor that exists. So this is a real challenge for Africa to maintain neutrality.
You mentioned the Ukrainian strive for self-determination, and I think it has to be respected. In fact, Russia made a pledge to respect it, but freeing itself from Russian political influence does not have to mean prostituting their land for the Americans. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, a public record right now is the effort by the West to expedite its militarization of Ukrainian territory. And I wonder, why do you think, what was the motivation behind it? Because it's hard to understand, again, after having all those wars and how much they cost the American taxpayers and how little they brought to the ordinary people in the United States and around the world, it's hard to understand why would the so-called neocon cabal, even though it includes many representatives of the Democratic Party, why would it persist on doing the same thing over and over and over and over again?
Well, I think if you listen to people like John Mearsheimer, they say that America believes it's the shining city on the hill, and they have a responsibility to protect populations as well as a responsibility to promote democracy. Unfortunately, the U.S. Repeats this process in country after country, because these people are simply not reflective. Afghanistan, they left with their tails between their legs. Libya is a complete mess. It was the best African country. It's an incredible catastrophe, and it's the same that's happening in Ukraine now. These were preventable crises. Had the NATO and the others chatted to Russia and come to some sort of agreement so that the Russians in eastern Ukraine could be protected, Ukraine could have been, as Professor Michael Hudson, who appears on your show, said, it could have been a bridge and a buffer. You see Zelensky now talking about neutrality. And if that proposition had been put forward between 2014 and now, a lot of the problems would have been solved. So when we come to why the neocons do things because they feel they have an obligation to the world, but they also very, very bazaary, like the Iranians say. They're just doing deals so that it works for their interests or what their perceived interests are. But I mean, if one just simply looks at a map of bases and missile stations, I mean, it's more than coincidental that Russia is actually being surrounded and being targeted as an enemy. I mean, the ridiculous notion that missile systems in Romania are there to protect Europe from Iranian missile strikes. This is the level of deception that goes on. That said, as race is constitutive in South Africa, in our politics, you're not going to get around the domination by the Soviets of Warsaw Pact countries like Ukraine. And it is formative. But at the end of the day, we know this invasion, or whatever euphemism you want to use for it, was preventable. And this violence is only going to get worse. The position that puts Africa in is that if this level of destabilization goes on, Africa is facing a crisis of enormous proportions. There are 300 million people now at risk of hunger. I mean, this is incredible. And we see the North or the US talking and Europe talking about concern for Africa, and they want to alleviate the food crisis. But, you know, it's like the rank hypocrisy of these people just does not arise, because at the WTO ministerial conference in June in Geneva recently, the US and EU were blocking poor countries from public stockpiling of food so that they can cater for emergencies. And then when it comes in the context of the Ukrainian war, they're all supportive of the African position. They block us from storing grain, so that they can make profits from higher prices, yet they pretend to care for African countries. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's probably because they also want to keep it for themselves, those grain supplies. And I think this is one of the very unique features of the Ukrainian crisis, is that for the West, chicken not only came home to roost, but it came home pretty soon. And it's not only the poorest countries of the South that have to deal now with the rising food and fuel prices, but also the developed world has to deal with certain insecurities, food shortages, energy hikes, political uncertainty in the United States ahead of the critical midterm elections. I wonder if you think that the West may have miscalculated what it was getting itself into when it picked up this fight with Russia, not only picked up this fight with Russia, but also made the whole world suffer the consequences of its decision to penalize Russia.
Overall, I think, you know, with the African position on neutrality, South Africa is pushing neutrality very strongly. Cyril Ramaphosa at BRICS said the same thing. It is a miscalculation on both parties' parts. I think there was an underestimation whether Europe could actually get united against Russia under the NATO banner. And we see that happening now. And I think it's a serious miscalculation from the US side, but the US can afford the miscalculation simply because it is surrounded by two oceans and is relatively secure. And also the proportion of expenditure by its people on food as a proportion of their income is much lower. It's 10 to 20%. Whereas in Africa, the proportion of people's average expenditure on food is about 40 to 50%. So, you know, the North and, you know, Europe and America can fool their people because they're saying this is Putin's inflation. But is it really? Because inflation was rising before the war. So even in the period 2020 to 2021, there was a 20% increase in the price of food, and now it's 40% over the,
over the
2 years.
If you look at the amount of money that both the EU and the United States have printed, it's pretty clear that that inflation is driven by the printing machine that is churning out money like crazy with absolutely no consideration for what's going to happen.
Well, the one thing is one can look at quantitative easing, which was necessary at the time. The problem is the distribution of the quantitative easing, which was pushed towards asset prices and the rich who own most of the stock market and bonds. It wasn't distributed to the people. I think QE was absolutely necessary to forestall a global crisis that was caused essentially by US derivative products and practices. But there is also significant market monopolization. So you have a few US and EU companies dominating international trade in coffee and grains, you know, people like Cargill, and then you have others like Monsanto and Bayer on fertilizers and so on. So they seem, the argument that we say it's money printing that's caused the inflation, no, it's also monopolization as well as rentier interests and people who are simply taking advantage of the crisis so that they can raise prices. And this is very indicative of the problem of rising inequality. I mean, it shows that the economic system pushed forward by the EU and the US, which is basically neoconservatism plus neoliberalism, shows that they really don't care about their own people. Actually, they could not care less about the impact on their people. And we wait for our activist and progressive friends in the North to actually start having discussions. You know, inequality is code for class, but why can't we say that there's a class war going on here?
Well, Riaz, we will talk more about that after a short break, but for the time being, we have to take it. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
to Worlds Apart with Riaz Tayob, researcher for the South African chapter of the Southern and East African Trade Institute. Riaz, before the break, we were discussing the implications of this conflict, as well as the globalized economic and political system for Russia, for Europe, for the United States. Now, let's turn our attention to Africa. And I recently came across a great quote from Akinwande Soyinka, a Nigerian playwright and poet, and the first sub-Saharan recipient of the Nobel Prize in Literature, who said that a tiger does not shout its tigritude, it acts. I wonder if part of the problem or part of the explanation for the mess that the world is in right now is that for too long, too many countries pretended to act rather than acted, and whether this crisis, as bad as it is, would force governments around the world to actually take their own decisions in the best interest of their own people rather than referring or deferring judgment to the so-called neo-lib or neocon cabal that you mentioned before.
I think for Africans, the situation is such that we're in a position of great dependency. And I think Russia needs to appreciate what great dependency we are in. You know, most of our countries are indebted to northern countries or Western banks, private in the private sector or on official loans. So the position of neutrality is very, very expensive for Africans. And on a civilizational level, what we see is we see a doubling down, or the US and the EU pushing neoliberal policies, you know, saying if you build it, we will come and invest, you know. And none of that has is really happening. Capital flows are down. And even if we do get inflows so that we can benefit, you know, from trade links or finance and investment links, you know, it hardly ever happens because they monopolize the sector or they monopolize the investment. So I don't see a major change coming through. And even with the accession of President Putin, Russia has followed a largely neoliberal path, even though it has changed its position on a, you know, having a weaker currency so it can encourage manufacturers. And we kind of forget that everyone literally copied the American system of manufacturers by Alexander Hamilton, who was then followed by Frederick List, and then followed by pre-Bolshevik Russia through Sergei Vita. And for example, Lenin did the Trans-Siberian Highway, you know, railway, which was actually one of the communication infrastructures recommended by Sergei Vita. And I think we will move to something like that, where countries focus on the actual gains of trade instead of making a country sexy enough for America to invest in.
Well, but I, first of all, I appreciate your deep knowledge of the Russian history, but I would also add from my side that I think Russia and some African countries, especially resource-rich countries, share certain similarities, because Russia too was, I think, seduced by the West at a certain point by, you know, allowing it to extract our natural resources in exchange for aid and developmental advice that seemed to serve the benefactors more than the beneficiaries. And yet at a certain point, the decision was made to cut down on external debt. And Russia, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, had enormous debt. It managed to pay it off. It also made certain moves in favor of self-sufficiency, so locating crucial industries within the country for the rainy day, which, as we see now, has come. Don't you think that that could offer some, you know, things to at least ponder about for some of the African countries, at least as far as self-sufficiency is concerned? Because I know that many of the African countries economically are very specialized, and that suits the globalist agenda, but that leaves them out in the cold when a pandemic or a major other disruption in supplies strikes.
Russia has done remarkably well after the Magnitsky Act and the sanctions that were imposed, you know, after that as well. Russia has certainly taken steps to improve its resilience and its productive capacity. But what we have not seen is Russia sterilizing the inflows of rubles or, you know, foreign exchange coming in, those that are allowed, like the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund does. Because if you have too much appreciation of your currency, it's going to knock your production productive capacity simply because your exports are going to become too expensive. And we haven't seen moves on that. On Russia's proposal to the BRICS and sharing of information, like the need for alternative credit ratings agencies or the need for an alternative payment system, I think here African countries can learn enormous amount from Russia, particularly on credit ratings agencies. And as well, I think Russia has to step up its support to African countries, particularly on the payment system, because this is where African countries are most vulnerable. You will see African countries changing tech, not because, the Soviet Union didn't support African countries, in the colonial anti-colonial struggles and all that, but because African countries are very dependent. A key thing here was the control the US and EU have over the WHO, the Russian Sputnik vaccine, was not approved, so it undermined Africans' ability to get the technology transfer that Russia offered so freely and practically. Anyone who said they dealt with the Russians on this was that they were offering real hands-on capacity building. And it was Bill Gates who stood up and said, no, we need to have this controlled. We're not going to approve it at WHO. We're not going to give funds for this kind of medicine. And this was a shortage. And they left the Africans with 17% vaccine coverage. And then they go to the WTO and so we're concerned about you. And they block steps that we can take to be self-reliant in vaccines. The situation is really, really incredulous. I mean, they left us hanging and the Russians were there, but we were constrained.
You seem to be using a lot of passive language here. They left us hanging. We weren't able to act. But, I like to quote this statement from one of the heroes of the Indian National Movement, who said that freedom is not given, it's taken. Don't you think that perhaps the time has come? And it's a time of chaos, a time when many governments are walking very tight ropes, but when they have to make crucial decisions for their populations to perhaps disobey some of these global wisdom delivering consortium and, make decisions that suit the people the best.
Yes, that is true. But, like the people say, we talk about Ukrainian sovereignty and it's, NATO's open door is sovereign for Ukraine to enter, it's a complete lie if you hear neocons say about that, because they undermine African and other people's sovereignty all the time. The reaction of the US to African neutrality on the UN Security Council decisions and in the General Assembly has been to pass an act that will monitor Russian activities in Africa as if they are a school teacher who can walk around with a cane hitting African countries. So the scope for action for African countries is very limited. African countries need to take a position that's more cunning, focusing on their interests, but they need to be cunning to do that because they will be put under IMF tutelage or not have access to medicines or have their funding cut for a lot of things. So that's why I was saying that Russia needs to understand the very precarious nature of African countries. And I think that if Russia and China can offer meaningful alternatives to African countries, we will be able to step out of the dependency. But without the US, but with the US pushing very strongly against Africans now, it's going to get harder and harder. And you will see some defections. For example, Kenya is talking a strong game against Russia when it's dependent on Belarus and Russia for so much of its fertilizer. It's going to face a fertilizer crisis because it simply won't be able to get them on the markets. Europe is going to take a first preference and Kenya is going to be left behind. So you see this happening already. But yes, we do hope our countries will focus on national interest. I mean, Putin stepped up and replaced shock therapy with nationalist interests. Sometimes we get worried about Alexandra Dugin and those kind of folks that are referred to. But we have not had our nationalist moment, our Putin moment, where after liberation or freedom from colonial domination, where we could act in the interests of our people.
Well, the picture you're painting is pretty depressive. So perhaps let me ask you one more question that is quite concerning, but maybe it has some hope in it as well. Many economists are warning about famine in Northern and Central Africa because of the rising fuel and grain prices. And I know that Russia, for example, takes it seriously. The head of the African Union visited this country just a few weeks ago, and he got reassurances from the Kremlin that Russia would do everything possible not to subject third countries to the negative implications of the Ukrainian conflict. But there are real concerns here that the West may intervene or interfere with the logistics for the sake of presenting Russia in a negative light. And I want to ask you about that specifically. Do you think there's anything that the African countries can do to make sure that these two opposing camps, Russia on one side and the West on the other side, could be brought to their humanity in delivering something as basic and something as necessary as grains to Africa? Do you think there's any hope of finding a compromise there? Not in Ukraine because it's too hot, but at least far away in Africa?
Well, like I said, the hypocrisy of the North knows no bounds. They are shameless.
Well, we are North. Come on. We are the largest northern country in the world, and we do believe that we care about humanity, not only our humanity, but everybody else's too.
I meant it in the dialectic of North and South, not geographic, but okay, I'll say the West, because of the silent century, Russia's position in the West is questionable, as the Europeans like to keep reminding us. No, I think there's a lot of hope because Macky Sall from Senegal is meeting with President Putin, I think, right now. And, you know, when you speak to diplomats coming out of meetings with the Russians or with the Kremlin, you know, they say they treated us with respect, they listened attentively, they asked pertinent questions, and they provided solutions and told us where the difficulties are. The primary cause of the shortages is basically the shipping routes and the the insurance. And I am not sure the US or the EU is going to move on this. So this crisis is going to continue. But what I think the Africans do appreciate is the very attentive nature and the concerned outlook that the Kremlin is giving. And, you know, it's so simple. You know, the Africans are saying, you know, the Russians treated us decently and with respect. I mean, you know, if you go to the WTO where Africans try and get some correction on the destructive subsidies, these subsidies that the EU and the US give, it's about $631 billion a year that basically allows European farmers to sell a product at a price that is lower than what Africans can produce. So I think on the food level and on the health level, the relations between Africa and Russia can be improved. But I'm worried about the African countries bending to the EU and US because of the pressure of hunger. And it's going to be devastating for our people. But I think what's coming out of the Kremlin in cooperation with the African Union is remarkable. We just need the EU and the US to stop their nonsense on sanctions and allowing shipping and insurance so that people don't die.
Yes, on this very sobering note, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your thoughts today.
Much obliged.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.